Welcome to AACP's podcast, Inside the Lab, where we discuss anything and everything that concerns today's laboratory professionals and pathologists. My name is Dr. Loti Mulder. I'm the Director of Leadership and Empowerment at AACP, and I'm one of your hosts.
Hey, everybody. My name is Kelly Swales, and I'm also one of your hosts. I am an AACP certified medical technologist, and I work as the executive editor of journals at the publications department at AACP. Today, we're going to be talking about transitioning leadership outside of the laboratory, and we have three great guests that I'll let introduce themselves.
Hi, my name is Gary Prokop. I'm the CEO of American Board of Pathology. Before that, I was a clinical microbiologist and infectious disease pathologist at the Cleveland Clinic for many years.
And I'm Ann Walsh-Feeks. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for Ambulatory Operations at Stony Brook Medicine in Stony Brook, New York, on Long Island. But prior to that, my clinical background with AACP is I am an AACP certified pathologist assistant.
Hi, my name is Carol Gomes. I am the Chief Executive Officer and Chief Operating Officer at Stony Brook University Hospital. And I am also a certified medical technologist. I also am a certified HTL and a diplomat in laboratory medicine. And I started my career in the laboratory.
Thanks, everybody, for joining us. Before we get to our discussion, I just got a little bit of housekeeping to get out of the way. CME and CMLE will be available for listening to this podcast in the AACP store. The American Society for Clinical Pathology is accredited by the Accreditation Council for continuing medical education to provide, you guessed it, continuing medical education for physicians. AACP designates this enduring material for a maximum of one AMA PRA Category 1 credit. Physicians should only claim the credit commensurate with the extent of their participation in the activity. All right, guys. Let's get going on our topic. Loti, you want to kick us off?
Absolutely. So my first question is, what career advice would you provide to those who wish to move into a management or leadership position?
Often when I give career advice about people who want to move into a management position, I often tell them to take advantage of participating on various committees that allow them to be exposed to other opportunities and other networks that they wouldn't otherwise have been involved in. And I also tell them to take advantage of joining professional societies, and that allows for opportunities for networking and also potential job opportunities as well.
You know, I can tag on to that. I have to say that when I was in pathology, my first opportunity to actually venture outside of the laboratory was in the realm of quality. It was in the early days, you know, I'm dating myself back in the 80s, but you know, quality was a new initiative back then, and I really liked it, and it gave me a chance to actually present at quality forums and really have a face in the organization outside of the laboratory. So that's something I really encourage people to do.
Yeah, I agree with Anne. I think that folks that are thinking about making these types of changes, they can often cut their teeth a bit by taking on some, you know, assistant or administrative type roles and help out, just like Anne mentioned, in quality. And you can actually get a taste of it, see if you like it or not. And, you know, if not, you may want to go in a different direction. If you like it, then figure out how to take the next steps.
One other thing I'd like to add too is, and this is something that I did when I had the opportunity, I maintained my clinical role as when I went into management initially as a path assistant. My first job right out of PA school was a supervisor of an anatomic pathology laboratory, and I wanted to practice. So for many, many years, I made sure that I had myself on the schedule with some degree of regularity. Besides the fact that I liked doing it, it also kept me in touch with my staff at all different levels. So I really do encourage people to do that. Sometimes people are quick to say, I can't wait to get away from the bench. But I do encourage them to think about a transition that allows them still to have that interaction.
In any type of that kind of experience, would you recommend that they do it within the institutions they're currently at, or at even volunteer opportunities at other organizations within the field? Or would it even matter if they got that experience outside of the field of pathology and laboratory medicine? Like, what would all of your advice be on that?
Well, I kind of like professional associations because it gives you the chance to network and also to get a vision outside your organization and potentially to find out about opportunities you might not be aware of. So, you know, back in my days as a path assistant, I was very active in the American Association of Pathologist Assistants. And that gave me tons of opportunities. But the other thing that it did do as well, and why I recommend that people volunteer, you know, and this is a push for ASCP as well, volunteer within your professional association, because you actually have the ability to develop a skill set you may not have previously had. I mean, I learned public speaking. I was afraid of getting up in front of a group of people. And I have to say that ASCP gave me the opportunity to really hone that skill. I learned about how boards function. I would never have gotten that experience if it had not been for ASCP. So again, it gives you a chance to really broaden your experience outside of your work, you know, your Monday through Friday type of job.
You know, I couldn't agree more, Anne. I also cut my teeth with ASCP boards and committee work. And I'm relatively an introvert, and it really allowed me the ability to be able to connect better with people, to develop communication skills, organizational skills, and the ability to run a meeting. And I don't know if I would have had that background and developed those skills had I not been a volunteer for ASCP. So I couldn't agree more.
Well, I like going last. These ladies have all the right answers. So I'm just gonna keep the theme up. I think they're right on the money. And I will say, and you know, it happens to this day, if I find somebody who can, you know, really run a meeting, I am just a student in that meeting, and I'm watching how they are doing it and adopting, you know, their best practices. But circling back to something Anne mentioned in the beginning, you know, we're all scientists at heart, right? It's science, 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 science. And then we come across all this entirely different group of skill sets that you actually need. Anne mentioned public speaking. You know, I remember one of the first papers I tried to write, it was so poor. I'll never forget the kindness of the professor who, you know, sat me down and gave me, I think, a basic English lesson. And now I'm not a bad writer, but you know, he had to do that for me, and that was very kind of him. But you know, accounting skills, you know, so many different skills that, you know, we really don't get in our classic training as scientists, that you know end up having to get a pretty good handle on to be successful in these types of roles.
You know, I think about too, you know, I have on my desk my certificate of completion of the ASCP Leadership Institute, the first one that Lotte did back in actually 2017. That gave me soft skills, I like to call them, the session on listening, the session on conflict management, time management. Things, you know, as Gary said, as scientists, those are not the things that we normally would have education on. And I found that was so helpful to me that I actually do pull it out periodically and just refresh myself on the various different components. But the other thing I like to say is, if you have an organization that gives you tuition reimbursement, I can't impress enough upon individuals, whether it's a certificate program, whether it's just taking coursework, or whether you choose to go into a degree program. I got my master's degree for free. I worked for NYU at the time, and I have a master's in health policy and management, which was a fabulous experience for me. I personally could not have afforded it. I mean, the tuition was incredibly expensive. I was able to go free, and I managed to work it around my work schedule. But I really encourage people, if your organization has tuition reimbursement, take advantage of it. Or even if there's internal CME activities, definitely take advantage of it. There's plenty of learning that's available outside of your particular lab.
I kind of want to touch on a little bit, because we've kind of been touching on skills that you can do outside of the laboratory, if like a management and leadership role is what your goal is. Can you guys talk about a little bit about what skills that you guys learned and honed within the laboratory that's kind of helped you climb up that ladder? So you're like on the off shift?
Yeah. So off shift, weekends, evenings, nights sometimes. So, you know, running multiple tests simultaneously and just keeping track of everything I had to do. And then even subsequent to that in histology, I had many different special stains cooking at the same time. So, you know, having timers going off and just being really facile with multitasking. I think multitasking is certainly something that has helped me, and organizational skills. But I think most importantly, I think that the critical skill set that I learned in the laboratory was about and around data performance improvement and quality assurance, which really was the stepping stone for me in terms of my progression from the lab to quality to operations. Really helped me to develop certain skills even further. But if I didn't have that foundational set of skills learned in the laboratory, again, I'm not quite sure if I would be doing what I'm doing now. And every step of the way, those skills that you just place in your toolbox along the way as you have stepping stones to career progression has really helped enormously.
One of the things that we work on in the laboratory is knowing how we fit into the system. You know, so in the residency, we call it systems-based practice. But it's amazing how many other subspecialties see it a little bit differently. I'll never forget, I had the opportunity to work in medical operations. And there was an issue with patients being in the hospital too long because consults were coming in for endoscopies while they were in-house, and the endoscopists weren't getting to them fast enough, so they were staying in the hospital too long and costing a lot of extra money. And I asked simple questions to us laboratorians like, do you have a stated turnaround time? And they looked at me like I was from Mars. So we have a lot of values that are just embedded in us in our learning of how to run a pathology or laboratory. And those can be very helpful outside the laboratory with respect to organization and timely completion of tasks.
So, you know, I like Carol's multitasking. I have to say, time management too is something that I absolutely learned. Because, you know, as a path assistant, your day is filled with, for the most part, you could be doing frozen sections, but that's never just your only job. You have a line of specimens waiting for you every time you have a break to go in and start to tackle. And it can look very daunting. And I think that if you don't have good time management skills as a path assistant, you typically can't continue in that career path because it becomes so incredibly stressful. So I learned early on how to ration my time and how to be very, very efficient in what I did. Because I didn't want to leave at 8 o'clock every night. And, you know, the better I got at it, the shorter my day became. And then, you know, I can leave at a reasonable time. But that was something hard for me to learn because everything was just so exciting. You know, you'd be doing a frozen section, like you wanted to stay and do more. But you realized you had a whole workload waiting for you in the other room. So that was something that it's carried me through. And I think I've honed my skills over the years in that particular regard.
Do you have any specific, or any of you, some specific tips and tricks that you have implemented that work really well in terms of time management?
You know, I do a list every day of priorities. And Carol and I have had this conversation. And I may have my priorities, but others' priorities kind of come into play. But I generally, because I can get distracted very easily, I will start the day with three things that I have to accomplish before the end of the day. And as I accomplish them, I obviously cross them off. And they're manageable things. But if I get diverted, they go to the wayside. And then, you know, the next day comes and it's on the back of my mind that I have to do it. So I actually do that. So I put three things that I absolutely need to accomplish before the end of the workday. And it works really well for me. Sometimes the list is longer, but I only focus on the three initially, and I don't allow myself to jump around.
I don't know if it's a good plan or not, but it works for me. I actually do four, Anne, and I set my hour up into 15-minute intervals. And no matter where I am, when that 15 minutes is up, I move to the next one on the list. So around the clock, around the day, I make sure I'm focused on one thing. And then when that time's up, I've got to focus on the next one.
Yeah. And here we have you for four whole 15-minute increments, Gary.
Right.
Carol, did you have anything?
No, well, you know, I was just listening to the others. And for me, organizing my time with meetings is one way that I can try to accomplish you know, getting the most out of my day. So instead of scheduling 1 hour meetings, I tend to try to schedule 30 minute meetings or 45 minute meetings, and then use the remainder of the time or the balance of the time doing all of my follow up so that at the end of the day, I don't have 5 hours worth of follow up.
And then looking at the transition to a role outside of the laboratory in terms of leadership, was there a pivotal event that was responsible for that transition, or did it happen in a more gradual way?
I can start. I mean, so in the late 1990s, suddenly everybody was worried about fairly significant changes that were predicted to governmental reimbursement. And the word reengineering reared its ugly head at the time. And I say that it reared its ugly head because it was the true test of change management. And most people do not like change. So my organization contracted with consultancy to do a top-to-bottom organizational reengineering project. And at the time, my boss was aware that I had just completed my master's degree. And I had come to him and said, you know, I'd love to take on any additional responsibilities, projects, things like that. So he actually recommended that I be considered to work with a consultant group. And they ended up choosing 5 individuals from the organization, and I was chosen. And I was responsible for working for it was almost a 2-year initiative. And we redesigned all the ancillaries. So pharmacy, imaging, laboratory. It was an amazing experience for me. It was probably the hardest time in my entire career. It was so incredibly stressful, but it was wonderful. And in the end, I ended up re-engineering myself out of my position. And the person who was doing it on an interim basis really liked it. And I wanted her to have the job. So I had the chance then to move into hospital operations.
Well done.
I had just passed the DLM, the laboratory management certification with ASCP, and my goal was to become a lab administrator. And at the time, I was applying for lab administrator positions, and I had actually 2 job offers that I was considering. And at the same time, I was participating on a performance improvement team representing the laboratory. And Gary, what other than to focus on lab turnaround times between, the emergency department and the lab. So I was the person who brought data to the meeting. I discussed the importance of pre-analytical and post-analytical time and tried to facilitate different people and personalities so that we can all come together toward a same goal. And unbeknownst to me, the chief quality officer was on the performance improvement team and had heard me one day talking about trying to determine which position I would take for a laboratory administrator role outside of my organization here, and had suggested that there was a job opening available for a director of quality for the hospital, not for the laboratory. And I was really not considering it, quite honestly. I thought of myself as a laboratorian first and foremost and didn't really consider leaving the laboratory, but the more I became knowledgeable about the position and I applied for the position, went through the process, I realized that it was an opportunity that, you know, I needed to take that risk and attempt to try to manage this new career. And I just figured if it didn't work out, I could always come back to the laboratory in the quality assurance role that I had previously. So it was a great leap and really was uncertain about whether or not I was making the right decision. But actually, at this point, I can say it definitely was the right decision because it helped me to learn more skill sets to add to my toolbox as I continued through my career progression, but never let go of that love of the laboratory.
Yeah, I think Carol brings out a really nice point about, you know, any of these leaps have a little bit of fear associated with them. Something brand new, et cetera. Am I going to be able to do it? Everyone, no matter who you are, has a fear of failure. You know, I think a couple of things. One is you had mentioned when you come from a successful place, you know, you can always go back to it. If things don't work out, that's okay. You know, sometimes you might have a little egg on your face, but that's all right. You know, we can deal with that. So there really is an out if you're, you know, well-trained in your previous career. And then I think the other is with that fear also comes a lot of excitement. You know, what things could we actually do to make the system better, et cetera. And I think if, as we talked about before, there's some good pre-planning, if you're thinking about going into these, take some of these courses through societies, to prepare yourself. And, you know, if you have some of that basic preparation, the chance of failure is a lot less. You know, you're more likely going to be successful. So I would never jump into something if I was unprepared for it. But, you know, if you've done your due diligence and you've started to prepare and then opportunity knocks, then it might be a little bit scary, but, you know, really think about going for it if it's what you think is for you.
Is there any advice you'd give for someone who's in the laboratory and then wants to make the jump to a leadership position outside of the laboratory? Is there any advice?
Well, I think, you know, Gary made a good point and kind of reiterated something that I had mentioned before, that you can always go back to your previous position. But really what I want to say is it is okay to let go. You know, we spend years working toward our undergraduate degree, and then you're in the profession and you believe that you need to continue to follow on that path. But think of it as building on to a very strong foundation. And the other piece is, you know, I always felt that as a laboratorian, I was making a difference. And I do believe we do make a difference every day in providing information to the healthcare team to help make decisions about diagnosis and treatment. And I felt that if I were to leave the laboratory, I would be losing the opportunity to make a difference in patients' lives and our communities' lives. But in fact, you can continue to make a difference with patients and lives through policy development and process changes and addressing community needs in very different ways. It's just a different way of making a difference for our patient population. So I thought I would miss that piece of it, but realize that there are other ways you can serve patients and the community.
I'd like to say too, you know, I made the decision when I left the laboratory to stay connected to the profession through ASCP, through my volunteering. And I've been an active volunteer since. And I, you know, I'm quick to say I'm not working in the laboratory environment. I'm not working as a path assistant, but my clinical identity is in the lab. So although you may look for opportunities outside of the lab and grow, I personally find it helpful to keep that connection going. It is my core. And, you know, and Carol knows, I'm going to retire in a few years, and my plan is I am actually going to go back to the bench. I am very excited about the thought of putting on my scrubs and going in and grossing and on a per diem basis, not
more. Yeah, I was going to say, you're going to go PRN, right? You're not going to go in at 5:30 every morning.
No. Yeah, I'm going to go PRN. But, you know, again, it's my identity. But the other piece of advice too is, don't be afraid, you know, to take an opportunity. I like to say that doors have opened in front of me. And for the most part, I've chosen to walk through and have confidence in yourself, because oftentimes the reason why that position is being offered to you is because somebody else sees in you that you've got what they need to get the job done. And although you might not think you have everything, and you know, the whole concept of imposter syndrome is very strong, I encourage people to really think about that. You know, be very careful, because you can be quick to say, you know, I don't have the full skill set, I don't have the full experience, but take risks and can learn along the way as well. Not to say, you know, there are some that say fake it until you make it. That is not my advice to anyone, but my advice is to really trust in your own intuition and what you know you can do and what you can do well, and look for an opportunity to grow and take on new responsibilities. Otherwise, you become stagnant. And the third part of it is find a mentor. Find somebody who you look up to, whether it's in the lab world or outside the lab world. Over my career, I have mentored so many people, which I personally find really, really rewarding. And even in my job here at Stony Brook, I have a few mentees that, you know, I'll be walking the halls, and I think Carol does the same. And, you know, out of nowhere, I'll hear, hi, Ann, and they want to catch up and tell me what they're doing or ask my advice on something. And I think that's great. So I also think that find a mentor. But don't forget, down the road, be a mentor to others yourself.
Yeah, pay it forward, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I really hear you, Ann, about the like believing in yourself and applying for the job, right? There's a saying that I've heard a lot is the idea that you shouldn't self-reject. Like, don't say, oh, they'll never want me. You know, make them say no to you, essentially. You know, I kind of am a proponent of fake it until you make it, because I will freely admit that I have over the years had a big imposter syndrome. So if I allowed that imposter syndrome to actually dictate what I did and did not do, I would not be where I am today. But I think for me anyway, that faking it until you making it, quote unquote, is a little bit a way for me to have that self-confidence to try something that I maybe think I can't do. You know, and also I kind of remind myself that, you know, like we're all just kind of like faking it at this whole adulting thing. We're all just kind of trying to make it work. So it's okay. We're all in the same boat in a certain aspect.
You know, I can share with you. So a good friend of mine, her daughter works at Stony Brook and she wants to move up to the next level, but she doesn't have a great deal of confidence. And I've known her since she was a baby. So I had her come over to my office last week and we went over the open positions because at Stony Brook, we have lots of jobs and we ranked them and we started to go through them. And I said, you can do this, right? And she goes, yeah, I can do this. So we actually narrowed it down and she applied for two of the positions and she's getting interviewed. And she was shocked afterwards. So again, when I say be a mentor, you can take it to the next level. I mean, I realized that she was struggling with trying to find something that would be appropriate for herself. And she was actually going very low, where my advice is typically go high. So that's an excellent exercise. So if somebody is looking to grow and they have somebody that they trust, you know, like my relationship with this young woman, go to that person and say, can you help me? And it was a simple matter of pulling up jobs. You can go to Indeed.com and narrow it down and saying, what do you like to do? What's your skill set? What are the things that you look when you wake up in the morning and you're on your way to work? What excites you about it? And find a job that fits that niche.
Well, and I think, you know, kind of within the conversation that's going on, I think it's important to be, you know, kind of honest and realistic. Don't apply for a job that there's no way you can do it. You know, if you say you're a programmer and you can't program, you know, you're going to get fired. So, you know, if you have certain program skills and as you said, you know, perhaps sit down with a mentor, what do you think about this? Can I do this one? Is it a little bit of stretch? And maybe even be honest. Say, this is, you know, to me, I'm all about honesty and transparency. This is what I can do. And this is where I'd like to go. And, you know, if you're the right fit, you know, they'll take you. And as mentioned, there's often funding for additional education, you know, on the job, et cetera. You know, it would be a bad thing to go into a position that you really were not qualified for, because I think that's just, you want to talk about things going from bad to worse. You know, right. Everybody's worried about fail. I'm worried about failing a job that I'm qualified for. But, you know, if you that's going to get even worse, the more failures that are added on. So, you know, I hear, you know, what everyone's saying, but at the same time, be realistic. What can you actually really do? And, you know, what skill sets do you really have? And not saying that they have to be perfect, but, you know, I would be realistic, too.
Right. Well, because that's kind of the point of looking for a new position, right? Or trying to make a step up the ladder that's kind of the point. You're not going to know everything about the job because you've not had the job. You want the job. You want to learn that stuff. So I think that's one way to look at it too.
Yeah. So then tying those things a little bit together, like education and knowing what you can and cannot do yet, and maybe finding that passion and potentially getting maybe a certificate or some additional schooling in an area. Have there been any particular certifications or degrees that were especially helpful in allowing you to make career transitions, either within pathology and laboratory medicine or beyond?
The master's program that I did was actually, it was referred to as the Advanced Management Program for Clinicians. And it was a program that was customized, recognizing that clinicians probably had limited time where they could, you know, go to class. And this is before, you know, anything remote. But the curriculum was very, very specific to healthcare management, budgeting and finance, compliance, regulatory, all of those things. So it really gave me a really good core of things that I did not necessarily have experience in. And then adding on to it, and I mentioned the Leadership Institute, which I found to be incredibly valuable, but I'm a lifetime learner. I'm always, if there's a podcast or there's something I can do at lunchtime, I'll throw something up on my computer. I think you just have to keep learning and look for opportunities to learn. It just so happens at Stony Brook, we have a program, we have a master's degree in healthcare administration that actually has all of the same components that my master's program had. And I can tell you in the last week, I recommended it to two physicians that I know who are looking for an opportunity to grow in the organization, to be leaders, and are feeling that they need a credential. And it's a very valuable credential. And actually, Carol's on the faculty. That's the kind of thing I recommend. So, you know, look, and it doesn't have to be a degree. And it doesn't have to be a certificate. It could be taking coursework that's filling in the gap of the skills that you feel you're either weak on or you don't have at all.
So, you know, building on that, and, you know, you mentioned that master's degree in healthcare administration, I have the same one, and it does focus in on healthcare related business aspects. And it helped me immensely for the first, I would say, 10 years or so outside of the lab. And what I realized once I became the chief operating officer, I really needed maybe a little bit more beefing up with marketing and accounting. And I guess Gary had mentioned before, you know, you need to really know your way around a spreadsheet and understand depreciation and bad debt and all of that. So even a master's in business could be very helpful. And then, you know, in terms of certifications for me, the certified professional in healthcare quality that's offered through the National Association for Healthcare Quality, many healthcare leaders have that credential, whether they've decided to go into a field within specifically within quality or not. That's been quite helpful. And then finally, the American College of Healthcare Executives as well, with the fellow, AFACHI, they call it, but it's that's a certificate as a fellow in ACHE. And you sit for an exam just as you do with the CPHQ exam. And it allows you to really broaden your perspective and your horizon on regulatory requirements in healthcare, governance structures, leadership, and all of those really important areas of focus that are required in order to become a leader or a manager in a healthcare organization.
I mean, I agree with everything that was said. I think that taking the courses and the appropriate preparation, just like I mentioned before, I'll say for myself and in my new role, I was in the middle of, and actually I'm just finishing a master's in education through Hopkins. I decided to take the education route and applying for this position. And, you know, our board is, it's all about assessment and certification. And, you know, certification and assessment really is integral with education. And so being able to weave those two together, I think was very helpful in being able to get this position. And then again, as far as preparation, you know, I had been a trustee on the board for kind of my full term, et cetera. So again, this idea of building a framework, building on information that you already know, and, you know, to Anne's point, you know, really having that mindset of being a lifelong learner. And I think then when opportunity knocks, you're ready for it. Louis Pasteur said, chance favors the prepared mind.
Exactly.
So you're prepared by the when opportunity knocks, you'll be right. You know, you want to be the top on the list.
Yeah. I kind of like the you make your own luck as well.
Make your own luck.
Looking back on your careers, is there anything that you would do differently?
Well,
or no, you did everything perfect and amazing and everything was just awesome all the time. Okay. Moving on.
I don't know that I would do anything differently. You know, as I've said, you know, mine was not a well thought out planned career path. You know, some people do that. You know, they know where they're going to start and where they want to end up and how they and the road that they want to take to get there. I have relied on chance a lot. I think it's made my work career a lot more interesting, because if I hadn't done that, I'd probably still be in the lab being a path assistant and probably being happy doing that, except that, you know, I had opportunity, as I said, you know, opportunities presented themselves to me and I obviously chose to accept them and to move on. So I actually have no regrets. I mean, I look back on it and as much as, you know, it may look like this crazy zigzaggy path, there actually is like a common thread through it that got me from point A to where I am today.
I probably jumped into kind of managerial type roles a little bit too soon. That would be my one regret. I think I would have liked to just been a staff doctor for, you know, a few more years before I like jumped to section head and then continued to move up. That would be the one thing I'd probably do a little bit differently.
And I probably wouldn't have do anything differently either. I don't have any regrets. And similar to Anne's experience, I've just been incredibly fortunate to have mentors and senior leaders who've believed in me, who've supported me, who've given me opportunities that I wouldn't have otherwise dreamed of, and never really seeking that next role. And it just, you know, somehow there were these opportunities in front of me. Again, my goal was to be a laboratory administrator. That was my career goal. And I just was afforded so many wonderful opportunities here at Stony Brook. And I was also very fortunate to be able to grow my career in one organization, which sometimes is rare as well. Sometimes you have to make a conscious decision to leave an organization to move into a role that you're seeking. And I just never had to do that. And I just feel incredibly fortunate.
That is, you are really fortunate to have been able to do that. And it's not particular, I don't think, to the laboratory industry. I think it's a lot of different industries where if you want to climb the ladder, you've got to move like every, 3 to 5 years.
Thank you. Can you explain a little bit more, elaborate a little bit on your answer? Like, why would you have stayed in that position a little longer if you had to do it again?
The more you move up, the more pressures are on you. You know, you're worried about managing larger and larger groups or operations. And I think there's an unspoken pressure that people need to move up. And if you know, I've always told my residents, follow your passion, do what you really love. If what you really love is moving up to position X, then you should really go for it. But if what you really love is working at the bench, you should do that too. So follow your passion. And, like I said, I think that, I probably just didn't get enough time of just being able to be a staff doctor and let somebody else worry about the budget and somebody else deal with the conflicts and those types of things. And, then when it was my time, move up. Jobs open up and, somebody says you'd be good for that. And, you are interested in it and you apply and get it. But that would be the only thing I'd do a little bit different. I think so. I got a little bit more of pure enjoyment without, the stress of leadership, if you will, a little bit longer earlier in my career.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially because I think sometimes maybe we can have some scarcity mindset of like, oh, this opportunity will only come around this one time. So I have to seize every possible opportunity that I receive versus like, they shall come again. Yeah.
Right. Well, and I also too think I've never really done this, but I know certain, some folks do is, I like you're saying, and I want to do X thing by Y age. And by the time I'm 40, I want to be X. I've never really subscribed to that just only because there's only so much within my control. One of the things that are completely out of my control is when positions open up, or what I'm willing necessarily, like if you've got a partner or you've got kids or whatever, sometimes moving is harder than it is for other folks or whatever. So I think really me personally, I think putting like arbitrary time stops on things, and if you don't do X by Y, then you're a failure. I personally think that's kind of a bad way to look at it. I kind of like what you guys are saying, where it's like, here's an opportunity. Am I ready to make the leap or not? Kind of thing. And to keep your options kind of open and keep an open mind about what your career could be.
And, as was mentioned previously, when you've got that a laboratory certification license, you could always go back. I mean, there's a job security that goes along with it. I mean, you oftentimes will hear this with nurses. Nurses can move from state to state and they can, they have to apply obviously for a license, but they have a career that they can jump into anywhere they go. And I actually think the same applies to many of us in the pathology world. Path assistants, they used to be few and far between the jobs. And now just about, every hospital has a path assistant. So you can always fall back on what you have, and it's a sense of security for those that might need it. And I think Carol said it first, it's a very, very valuable commodity to have that license and to be able to consider going back to it if you needed to or wanted to.
Is there anything that you guys miss about working in the laboratory that you don't really get in your current jobs?
Is it your clinical identity?
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Gary mentioned before science, we're scientists by nature, because obviously that's the interest that we had undergrad. And I just always loved science, chemistry, physics, all of those sciences. And moving into the management position, that's what I miss the most is, you know, being in the laboratory and when I'm rounding and I see people around a microscope looking at cells, I'll say, hey, can I check that out? What are you looking at? I'd love to see it. And I miss that every day, but I certainly can get my fix by rounding in the lab and asking, you know, what's happening and what's interesting that's going on. What's the new technology that's been installed in the laboratory? But the beauty of working at an academic medical center is that we are continuing to be exposed to the academics, a lot of really cutting edge research, and also the clinical arena. So I do still feel like I can get my fix of science, but that is what I miss the most every single day, day to day.
Yeah, I am with you, Carol. I mean, that was the, I really miss the patient care aspect and, you know, your clinical colleagues calling you and saying, could you look at this slide? And boy, I tell you, if you can ever find an Aciphest bacillus when nobody else can, you know, you've changed the course of therapy for that patient, et cetera.
Yeah, you'll fly high on that for like 3 days. That's amazing.
Yeah, and you know, I think that, you know, that goes to, you know, timing of moving up being important. So, you know, if you've done that enough, so you kind of, quote, have had your fill of it, not that you're tired of it, but, you know, you've satisfied, you've really had a fine career there. Then I think when you move to these other positions, I think each of us would probably agree, there's a feeling of you're working for the greater good. You know, you're trying to actually improve the entire health system or the like. So, you know, you've had that, it's still part of you, but now you're helping, you know, in even a bigger way, if you will, for all those patients.
You know, I have to say the one thing I do miss though is teaching. I was always in an organization that had a residency program and the PAs were responsible for training the first years. And it was something I absolutely loved to do. And actually to this day, I'm in contact with former residents of mine. And this is going, you know, almost 40 years later. It was a very meaningful thing for me to do. I absolutely loved it. So that is the one thing that I do miss.
You're going to have to add that to your PRN list, Anne. They'll be happy to have you back as an educator.
They'll have to teach me first. They'll have to bring me up to speed first on what I need to do.
Well, you know what it is, you know, see one, do one, teach one, right? Yeah, you'll figure it out. Well, guys, I want to thank you guys for taking the time to talk to us today. This was a really interesting conversation, and I hope our listeners find that as well. Speaking of our listeners, I want to remind you guys to subscribe to the podcast and also tell your colleagues about Inside the Lab.
And as always, don't forget that you can receive CME and CMLE credit for listening to our podcast by looking for Inside the Lab in the AACP store on our website at www.aacp.org.